Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al. There's
always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This special episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk about the history of bodybuilding and we talk to the historical bodybuilders themselves. And unfortunately, today we're doing a special podcast, but it's not happy news. It was the passing of Ed Corney this week on January 1st, 2019, the very first day of the year. The legendary bodybuilder Ed Corney passed away at the age of 85 from a brain aneurysm. So I thought instead of having part two of our interview with Jerry Branum, as we were supposed to have, where we were going to talk about the year 1978, we would have a special episode dedicated to the memory of Ed Corney, because he was such a great old-school bodybuilder, such a legendary bodybuilder, and I did want to do a special episode. So I tried to talk to a few people that knew Ed, including Arnold Schwarzenegger. I actually sent an email to Arnold, but I, of course, did not hear back, which I didn't expect to. I also tried to get Charles Gaines on the show, because Charles, of course, was the author of the book Pumping Iron, and they used Ed's picture on the cover of that book. And then Charles was also instrumental in the movie Pumping Iron, which was directed by George Butler, his partner. And George, of course, took the pictures for the book Pumping Iron. And Ed was also featured extensively in the movie Pumping Iron. So he's one of those few bodybuilders who was featured in both the book and the movie. And Ed was the training partner of Arnold Schwarzenegger in the movie Pumping Iron. And he was, of course, competing in the Mr. Olympia that year also, where he took second place to Franco. So the scene of Ed doing those squats with Arnold is pretty legendary now. I've seen that posted on social media all this week after Ed passed away. But what Ed was really known best for was his incredible posing. And he redefined the sport of posing. And if I got a chance to see him actually in 1977 when he took third place in the Mr. Olympia, and he got like three standing ovations. And I think that was probably the highlight of his bodybuilding career. So I was very lucky at 14 years old to be able to see him in person and see that moment in bodybuilding history. So I know how special Ed was in that regard. He was also a great person. And so that's why I just didn't want to just mention it at the beginning, but I want to do a complete show about Ed to commemorate his great career as a bodybuilder. So we did get a chance to talk to Mike Katz, and I'm going to have that interview coming up in a second. And I got to talk to Mike about his memories of Ed Corney, because Ed was a good friend of Mike's going back all the way to the early 1970s. And in 1972, Ed and Mike traveled together to Baghdad, Iraq, as part of the American team to compete in the IFBB Mr. Universe, and they knew it was going to be between the both of them. And this was also covered in the book Pumping Iron. So Ed actually won the contest. He won the overall, and Mike Katz won the tall class. So and then they were also in the movie Pumping Iron together, so they traveled down to Pretoria, South Africa. So it was a real pleasure to talk to Mike Katz about his memories of his friend Ed Corney. And then we also have an interview on the show today with Roger Schwab. And Roger was the head judge of the IFBB, particularly in the late 1970s. So he was right there, front stage and center, to see Ed Corney do his posing routine in 1977, the one I just mentioned that was so historic. And he, of course, had a chance to know Ed also. So we got a really good interview coming up with Roger Schwab as well. All right, so before we get to those interviews, I do want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe and the Masters competition. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the current Classic Physique Olympia champion for both 2017 and 2018. And Breon is also the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Benoot and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order at oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs supplements that make sense. And we're also brought to you by our other sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, which is 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, flalternativemeds.com, or their office number, 813-922-8939. And mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and you will get a free consultation, and you will also get 20% off your first order. All right, so here is the beginning of our interview with Mike Katz, and right after that, we're going to talk to Roger Schwab. So please enjoy this memorial to the great Ed Corney on this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and it's my honor and pleasure to have Mr. Mike Katz joining us again. Mike has been on our show before, and we wanted to bring him back today to talk about his friend and bodybuilding legend, Ed Corney. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Yeah, thank you for allowing me to touch base with your audience and show the respect and love that I had for Ed always and forever. And I was shocked in the way, I won't get into details, but somebody who I hardly know just came by in a social setting and said, "Did you hear, you know, that Ed passed?" Mm-hmm. And I was so shocked that he thought maybe I wouldn't have taken it. So unbelievably sad. It was just not, you know, the way in a perfect world I would have wanted to hear that he had passed away. But
yeah,
I lost one of my very best friends last week, and I haven't recovered from that. And then I lose Ed. And I guess the problem is, as I live longer, I'm going to obviously have to deal with the passing of many of my friends until I die, and then they're going to be talking to you about me. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just read the book Pumping Iron again yesterday, or actually this week, you know, because of the part in there about Ed and you, and I thought that was one of the highlights of the book, was when you guys took that trip over to Iraq, Baghdad, Iraq, to compete in the 1972 Mr. Universe. And you guys were the only ones on the American team, because I think Waller got hurt, right? He was supposed to be on. He got hurt doing leg presses or something.
Yeah, I you know what? It's not that it's news to me, but as I get older, I like many guys who get older, you kind of suffer from a little bit of memory loss.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's the case, then I kind of don't remember that happening, but.
Yeah, I just thought that was a great part of the book, though, how you guys were traveling together to this strange land, and, you know, yourself being Jewish, and you were going over to an Arab country. I know you're a little apprehensive about that. Yeah. But that was just great how you guys were traveling together, you know.
Yeah, my father couldn't believe it that, you know, I was young and obviously naive, and they took my passport, and you're never supposed to give your passport up. They took the passport. I got home, and I told my father what happened. He couldn't believe it. But I had no choice. They were going to take the passport and give it to me when I left the country. And we were on good terms, you know, with that government. I don't know who was running Iraq then. But obviously, you know, if I felt my life was at stake, I never would have gone there. And
yeah.
As a matter of fact, no American team, if we thought we were going to get hijacked, you know, for ransom and stuff like that. So, you know, Ed Corney and I, just, you know, to reminisce, because I don't want to forget certain highlights of that trip to Baghdad that have never been written about.
Uh-huh.
A shish kebab is a shortened term in the Arab world is a kebab, and not a fish kebab. And the only thing that we could really eat that we thought was going to be safe was a beef kebab with no vegetables or anything else. So we were able to get our 200 or 300 grams of protein by just eating beef on these kebabs. So they knew, the waiters knew exactly, you know, bring us 20, you know, shish kebabs with no vegetables on them. And after a while, they probably ran out of meat in the country because of me eating 4 pounds of beef a day. I must have cost the Arabs an awful lot of money.
That was a funny part of the book, too, because it said how you guys were afraid to drink the water, and you had to mix the water with your protein drinks, and you thought you heard there was like these little snail things in the water, and you were afraid to drink it.
we wouldn't have been. I sure as heck, if I got sick intestinally, I couldn't eat the most muscular, because it would have been not a very pleasant smelling most muscular, that's for sure. But I can remember we went to, there was a big party that was held in a famous hotel, and it was outside in a garden with fountains, and it was probably like a palace. And they had a fish, this fish, now again, you know, Paul Bunyan's story, you know, he chops down a tiny tree in Connecticut, and by the time he gets to California, the story's a one swipe and he knocks a redwood down. So the story probably gets embellished over the years that it was a pretty big fish, and then it was a really big fish, and then the fifth or sixth time, 30 years later, this was about, you know, a great white shark.
Right.
in the center of a table. I thought the table was going to collapse, and you have all these well-dressed, you know, Iraqis, and Eddie and I were very fortunate because we were standing with our backs kind of lean. There was no place to sit, and we were tired, so we kind of leaned with our backs against a wall, and there was some kind of a chime or signal or bell, and then that bell went off. About 400 Iraqis ran to this like 700-pound fish, like piranha, and I guarantee within 3 or 4 minutes there was nothing but bones.
Oh my God! Unbelievable.
So Eddie and we would have got trampled. I wouldn't have even been able to compete because if we weren't with our back against the wall, these people were, like, starved to death. It was their last meal. So Eddie and I said, let's go in a restaurant and get some kebabs. I'm not fighting over freaking fish. So there'll be some other stories that probably...
Now, when did you meet Ed?
I would say the first time I went there was 1970. Gold's Gym in Venice. And probably was then, because Eddie would come down and train with Arnold, and Ed Corney and myself were perfect training partners because not only did we train that way, but we believed in it. So Arnold didn't have to convert us because he never could convert Franco to do what he wanted. So him, you know, the odd couple with Arnold and Franco, like Danny DeVito, he was never going to train with Franco. It's just, there's no way. And Muscle Beach, they did down the street. You know, he'd spot Arnold. They'd hang upside down on the chinny bar. But Eddie was, you know, pound for pound, almost as strong as Franco. And
oh really?
Tremendous. He's very strong and great dedication. I look at Lee Haney as my, honestly, well, I go to Bill Pearl, who I know hopefully might be listening, who's the ultimate Reg Park, but Bill Pearl was my idol. I would kind of idolize different people for different reasons, but, you know, Bill Pearl's a great guy. Lee Haney is as great a gentleman as you're ever going to meet.
Right.
And it's not that other guys are not as good. I'm just making a value judgment on my friends. But Ed Corney's right in there, you know, with Reg and with Bill Pearl and with Lee Haney, who I admire. And for me to mention Ed Corney in the same Brett, as I mentioned, these other fellows who I idolized, I can't say anything more highly about a great guy, great bodybuilder. You know, there's been two or three guys who have kind of made my hair stand up when I had hair and actually made me, in a way, shiver. I don't know if that's the right word for the emotion, but obviously when Ed Corney would post to My Way, I'm trying to think if it was Phil Hill, but there was I think it was Phil Hill, and he started a posing routine in a sort of a full squatted plié position like a ballerina.
Yeah,
that was the audience. Mm-hmm. It was Phil Hill, and he came out of it as if he was a budding rose. Beyond that, I'd have to lie. Arnold would like me to lie that he was as great a poser as Ed Corney, but Arnold knows that that's not true. You know, those two guys come to mind as the people who I think would, and again, most people wouldn't even think of Phil Hill. I thought of him because I judged him.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that routine. I think it was in Madison Square Garden, or it could have been at in New York someplace when he won, but those two posing routines for me were the ultimate.
Now, Mike, were you and Ed pretty close? Did you know each other well when you took that trip over to Baghdad for the 72 University?
Oh yeah, that's why we roomed together, not only because we were Americans, but you know, there could have been 30 guys from America, they would have put me and Ed together. You know, we were training partners with Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Arnold would probably say that, you know, we were among the best training partners he ever had. And I don't think I'm putting words in Arnold's mouth, but I think Arnold said that on one of the social media things about what a great training partner and poser he was.
Yeah, yeah.
So, we've known each other. I'd say we knew each other from 1970 when I first went to California. And I, more or less, I trained with Arnold more than Ed Corney, but when Ed came into town, the three of us would train. We would pick three exercises. We weren't going to do one exercise and then wait. We'd take three exercises. Like we'd take a squat, a leg curl, and a leg press or a leg extension. One would be on one, like Arnold would be squatting, I'd be on extensions. Eddie would be on leg curls. And then as soon as we were done, we all just rotated. So there was no resting, you know, between sets. So you'd say, well, how do three guys train together and get a good workout? You're resting like a power lifter too much.
Right.
So we just try set it like bench press with dumbbells, flies, you know, with a pec machine or cables or dumbbells, and then we do pullovers in a tri-set. Each one would do their own exercise, and when they were done, we just moved to the next station. So,
you know,
when you got these 30-minute express workouts, or you've got these high-intensity workouts where there's no rest, most people back in the 70s and late 60s, they weren't training like that. It was just a rest, a set. So you rested 3 hours and you worked out for 20 minutes, you know. I'm a little bit facetious, but the high-intensity training, you know, I don't know who invented it. Arthur Jones, you know, his big thing when Arnold and Franco went to Florida was, you know, his big thing was to try to make them throw up, you know.
Make them
train so hard. Mm-hmm. So that Jones and Arnold, you know, would laugh at Arthur Jones because Arnold wasn't going to throw up during Arthur Jones's Nautilus workout.
Right.
There's a lot of stories, you know. Obviously, this is about Eddie, and I'll try to stay on tune with Eddie. But a lot of the stuff, you know, is not just Eddie. It's about Eddie and everything else that went on.
Now, how good of a poser was Ed back in '72 when he won that universe?
Well, as I said, I had Eddie in probably the 70s, mid-70s. I had him come up to Connecticut, Southern Connecticut State University, and he was a guest poser. He stayed at my house.
Uh-huh.
And I saw his posing routine. I saw three typewritten pages, single space, of that posing routine to Frank Sinatra's My Way.
No way, really? Wow.
You know, I wouldn't have had 14 words, three pages,
right?
Types, single spaced, and I'm going, you know what, this is too complicated. I don't care about being the best poser. I want to be the biggest freak out
there,
be the best poser, because I can't memorize that well. ABC's are sometimes tough, let alone 4 pages of notes on when he hits this shot and how he opens up his index finger from his pinky finger.
Wow, that's amazing.
Forget about it, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Ed was the, you know, I mean, Gene was memorialized, of course, in the movie Pumping Iron. But, you know, when he did those slow transitions, those powerful transitions, I think that's what really set him apart from everyone else. And I did an interview once with Boyer Coe, and Boyer Coe said, he goes, wow, when we saw Ed Corney pose, we all had to step up our game, you know, because this guy was just taking posing to a whole new level.
You see, the good thing for the guys who, you know, sort of just wanted to be freaks and scare everybody was that posing didn't count in the scores. Now, there was certain years, and, you know, you can historically, you know, whether it was AAU or whatever, there were certain years way back when I started where posing was, I think, 1/3 of the score. I think it was symmetry and then muscularity and then posing. And I don't know if it just got too complicated because you got guys who could pose, they had no body.
Yeah.
You know? And then they would be the guy who had a far better body, but these guys who just were posing freaks would come in and win a contest. So I think they just figured, you know what, posing's for the audience. The contest has already been decided. You've done your mandatories and prejudging. And, you know, if you're a great poser, that's good for the audience. But it wasn't part of the score because I think everybody would have had to upgrade their time posing. Although, you know, if you were a really good poser, you could probably make a little bit more money on the circuit, you know, doing posing routines for contests and stuff because you just, you know, if you were a jerk and didn't give autographs or you weren't friendly to the news media, the word got around fast that you weren't the kind of a guy that a promoter's going to bring in for $500. And I mean, at that time, $500, you know, Mr. Olympia was $1,000.
Yeah.
You know, back in 1970. So you're talking about getting $500. I mean, it took me 2 weeks or 3 weeks teaching school to make $500.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you got to put things in context that, you know, you wanted to be friendly, Eddie was friendly. You wanted to be a good poser, Eddie was the best. You wanted to cooperate with the media, Eddie was right there. So, you know, he made an awful lot of friends because he was extremely cooperative and wasn't, you know, one of these egotistical jerks like some people are.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, some of the people I'm talking about are in prison who were, you know, convicted murderers and people who, you know, I don't know whether they, whatever drugs they were on or whatever other drugs they might have been on, but they were just people who nobody wanted to guess pose because you didn't know what they were going to do.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
A real quick story about Sergio, which I'm sure everybody would like to hear. I'm sure Eddie's listening as well up in heaven, because he sure as heck in heaven. I remember the most difficult guy to deal with in readying him to give a posing exhibition was Sergio.
Yeah.
I mean, Sergio would have a three-hour workout getting pumped up. So, you know, you would actually tell Sergio, I hope you're ready. And you knew Sergio was going to pose at the end of the show, but you would tell him, like Arnold would tell him, Sergio, you got to get ready. It's 8:00. Now, you know Sergio's not coming on until 12 or 1.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd tell him to get ready for an 8:00. You're going to be coming out first. And you knew Sergio wasn't going to be ready. Now, Ed Corney would get ready doing 3 push-ups, a couple of push and pulls, Ed Corney's on stage. Sergio, you know, maybe 11:00, 12:00 after he starts his 8:00 pump up, you know, he'd be ready.
Yeah.
It was like, if he wasn't so good, there wouldn't be anybody in there to watch the routine. But, you know, you had to get him pumped up 3 or 4 hours ahead of time where Corney would, you know, he'd probably, like Popeye, he'd blow on his thumb like he's blowing on his bike.
Right.
He'd be freaking ready, yeah.
How did Ed feel about making the cover of the book Pumping Iron? I mean, that had to be special for him, right? Because so many bodybuilders featured in that book, and he was the one on the cover.
Yeah. Can you imagine what, you know, if you were a fly on the wall and Arnold saw Corny on the cover? Oh, my God.
Yeah. One of the things that was great about that movie, Pumping Iron, was the camaraderie you guys shared together. And you could see that. It was so obvious in the movie. And do you remember that, Mike, how much do you remember that end of the contest when you guys were all celebrating the birthday of Lou Ferrigno and Eddie Corny?
Yeah. That I just wanted, like Louie, I just wanted my cake. and here's Arnold in 1975 smoking a joint.
Right.
You know, it's like,
right.
Oh boy, was he ahead of his time.
If you remember those shows where he, now particularly the 77 one, and that was the year that Pumping Iron came out, and I was actually at that contest. I was a 14-year-old kid, but I remember Ed got like 3 standing ovations that day, and it was just unbelievable. That would be the highlight of his life.
Well, I'm sure I was there judging because I judge every big show, the Arnold Classic, the Olympia. I've judged probably for 20 years those shows. So
right.
I was there. You know, when I see Ed, you know, it didn't, I mean, the audience reaction with 3 standing ovations would not be something uncommon. You know,
yeah.
I'd say, well, why didn't he get 5 standing ovations?
Right.
I mean, I grew up with him and I've seen him. So whether he got 3, 4, 5, you know, whatever, he wasn't, believe me, I've seen him. So maybe it was a combination of 2 or 3 of the routines together, which may have set the audience off instead of just his patented one opposing routine.
Yeah. Yeah, another thing that struck me about Ed as I was looking over some of his pictures is how he continued to compete even as he got older. I mean, he was in the 1983 Mr. Olympia that Samir Benoot won. He was, you know, obviously past his prime then, but I think he just enjoyed the whole process of bodybuilding and getting in shape and, of course, getting up in front of the audience and posing.
Yeah, that's why Tony Bennett's almost 100 and he's still singing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you get addicted to the stage and the reaction from the people. I mean, Robbie was the same way.
Yeah.
To this day, I don't think Robbie ever misses a workout.
He's unbelievable.
The guy's a total freak. I mean,
yeah.
You look at him, there's, you know, you take somebody like him at his age with I'm sure no drugs at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Genetically was extremely gifted, and if he did anything, it was next to nothing.
Anything else you want to say about your friend Ed Corny? I know, you know.
We're all going to be up there watching him post. You know, none of us.
Yeah.
You know, we got to pay taxes or go to jail, and we're going to die because that's part of being born.
Right. Right.
So I just hope I could put it off for a while, but you know, he's the first, one of the first guys I'm going to look up. You know, as long as God has planned for me to be in heaven, so. Because I know he's there, so I just got to behave myself, so I'll be there too.
Yeah, I know.
Love you, Ed Corny. I love you, Ed Corny, and everybody loves him. I never heard a bad word about Lee Haney. I've heard some bad words about Arnold. I won't get into it until I'm dead, and then I'll have a book that will unearth so he can't kill me. But never a bad word could be said about Ed Corny. And, you know, that's a hard thing after 80-something years.
Yeah, that's
true.
To
be alive and to still be considered a gentleman,
yep.
A good guy, a good father, a good husband, a good person. That's what life's about.
Yeah, you know, I could see that, Mike, this week on Facebook when he died because there were so many people that were really moved by this. And Ed lived a long life. He was 85. I mean, if I lived 85, I will consider that a long life, you know. But there was just so much affection, so much sympathy from the bodybuilding world when he died. So that just goes to show you how he was thought of, you know.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I can mention, because I'll keep mentioning stuff, but I know your show's got only so much length to it, is that here's a guy that had a stroke probably 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, true. You
know? And most guys would have had the vanity or lack with their vanity. They would have said, you know what? I'm just going to die out in the desert someplace and, go up to the North Pole and let a freaking polar bear eat me like the Inuit people sometimes, at least they say they do. But here's a guy that still went to the Arnold, still went to the Olympia, signing autographs,
Yep.
Still was active. Not sure of his wife or girlfriend, but she was a sweetheart, and she was there stabilizing him. And, you know, and again, he lived for the audience. He lived for the fans and the adulation from the fans. And
yeah,
it's just a lot to do with his character. I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if my, I kind of hope I don't get tested.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of just meekly die in my sleep. But here's a guy that was out there even with a stroke and hobbling around and going from airport to airport. And
yeah,
you know, we could all learn. Everybody listening to this show and the people who aren't listening, man, we could learn some stuff about character and about fortitude.
Mm-hmm.
The list can go on and on about the kind of a guy. So, you know, you talk about his posing, but that's nothing. You know, you got to take away trophies. You got to take away accomplishments.
Mm-hmm.
You got to take all that stuff away, because really what it is isn't that, because that stuff doesn't make up for a person being a good person.
Yeah,
you could be the biggest jerk, the biggest rotten person in the world. So, you know, you're the light heavyweight champion or middleweight champion. That boxer is supposed to be a son of a bitch, you know, who the middleweight guy, you know, is supposed to be a jerk. Now, whether he is or whether he isn't, I don't know him, but, you know, a lot mm-hmm. of people don't look up to him. But there's nobody who heard of or knows Ed Corney that's not going to have looked up to him. And that's all that I want, is my kids. I taught school for 35 years, and I know my kids love me, and I love them, and I cared about them, and I care about all people. So when you get that kind of a person who cares that he didn't win Mr. Olympia, or he didn't win over the 60, or, and, you know, so don't just think he was a great poser.
Yeah.
Because that's least amount that anybody ought to be thinking about. Ed Corney mm-hmm. was like Lee Haney, and I keep saying Lee Haney and Lee Haney, and anybody who knows Lee Haney, if he goes before me, I go before him, at least I've given him his dues.
Yeah.
And Bill Pearl and Reg Park, and I know I'm forgetting people. Dave Draper's a great guy. You know, you ought to listen to his writings. He's probably the most talented writer.
Yeah.
He's got his own columns, and I'm sure,
right.
you know, it's just fun to listen to Dave Draper and read his words, and the guy's a sweetheart. I know I'm leaving other people out, but
right.
these are colossal people in the sport.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, you could be a multimillionaire like Arnold, and I'm not downgrading Arnold at all.
Yeah.
He's a good friend. He's been a loyal friend. If I ever really needed him, which I'm happy I don't, whether it's financially or emotionally, I'm on a bridge. I want Arnold to come, or I'm going to jump. Well, maybe he wouldn't come. And I jump and I say, you son of a bitch. You know, when I need you most, you're freaking doing something to make money instead of coming to get me off the goddamn bridge. So I'm only fooling. You know, I love Arnold, but, you know, the kind of – I'm not an Arnold kind of personality. I'm a Lee Haney kind of person. I'm a Bill Pearl. I'm a Dave Draper. I'm an Ed Corney kind of person, and it doesn't
yeah.
get better. It just means that I can relate to them a little bit more.
Right, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no matter what his accomplishments, it's the kind of person that Ed was, and that's what we should remember.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't be having this show, and nobody would have cared how good of a poser he was if he was, you know,
a jerk. Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. Absolutely. All right, Mike. Well, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know you're very busy, and I appreciate you calling in. All right. That was great to hear from Mike Katz. I'm glad he had a chance to join us. I know he's very busy. And now here's an interview that I did just this week with Roger Schwab. And Roger, as I mentioned, was the head judge at the IFBB. And Roger got a chance, as well as I did, to see Ed Corney perform at the 1977 Mr. Olympia. So we're going to talk a little bit about Ed Corney's career as a bodybuilder and what he meant to the sport. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends Show, and I have my old friend Roger Schwab on the line with us today, and we are here, of course, to talk about the life and the career of the great bodybuilder Ed Corney, who just passed away last week. Roger, how you doing?
I'm great, John. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Happy New Year. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you also. It's just a shame that we have to reflect on the career of Ed Corney, who passed away, I think, on New Year's Day.
What an impact he had.
tremendous impact on our sport, especially during the golden era.
Right. Well, Roger, you and I were both fortunate because I know I was at the Mr. Olympia contest from 1977 through 1979, and I also went back in 1981 when it was at Columbus, Ohio, and Arnold and Jim Lorimer were promoting it, and Ed was a big part of those contests back then because he was really at his peak. And you were the head judge in the IFBB during those years, so you were right there at the stage, and you got to see Ed in person. What was the first time you met Ed? Because I know you were in California, right, in the mid '70s when they were making pumping iron.
Yeah, they were great heady days at Gold's Gym in the early '70s, especially the mid '70s, I would say. And I happened to be out there during some of the filming of Pumping Iron, and that's when I first met Ed Corney. I had seen pictures of him, certainly when he won the IFBB Mr. America in the early '70s, and when he went to Baghdad, I believe, and won the Mr. Universe in 1972 also. But
right.
California in 1975 is when I first spoke to him. And he was a gentleman at the first meeting that I had with him. And as I related to some people, he was always one of the first to speak to me after the Olympia contest. And to his credit, he always spoke with respect, even though at none of the contests that I judged did he win.
Mm-hmm.
He was just interested in what he showed, what I thought, how he could improve if he was better than the previous year. And he always did it dignified and as a gentleman. He was really a lot of fun guy and serious when he had to be. But what he did on that stage, nobody else, in my opinion, in the history of the sport, did previously or subsequently.
Yeah, yeah. So the first time you actually met him in person was in 1975. Did you ever see him on stage before that, before 1975?
No, I had never seen him on stage. The only the first time I saw him was training at Gold's, and for subsequent days training at Gold's, which I can tell you were always intense days. If Corney had a light day, I never saw it.
Right.
The same could be said of Arnold or Draper or Zane or Serge Jacobs at the time. They all trained hard.
Yeah. Now, we all know that Ed was training with Arnold in 1975, and that was captured in the movie Pumping Iron. So did you get to see those guys training together during that time?
You know, there was a small snippet of Pumping Iron where Arnold walks into the gym in Gold's Gym, and Ed Giuliani jumps into his arms. And
right.
A keen observer can notice right behind Arnold is this smaller guy walking in a black shirt and black sweatpants, which happened to be me. So I was there at a lot of the training sessions when Butler was filming Pumping Iron.
Yeah.
Great days.
Absolutely, yeah. One thing I remember about that was Ed was really like sort of honored to be training with Arnold, and I read this old article recently in one of my old Muscle Builder magazines. And I got it out, I think it was from 1976, and Arnold and Ed talked a lot about training with Arnold and how much that meant to him and how much it really changed his philosophy. And he was very insightful and very thoughtful in this article. And so it was like a real honor for Ed to be not only a part of the movie Pumping Iron, but just to go into the Mr. Olympia and compete with the best. And him and Franco went down to the wire that year in 1975, and he actually beat Frank Zane. A lot of people forget about that. But just to be a part of the whole process and train with Arnold and go through that whole experience, I think, of getting ready for a contest with the greatest bodybuilder ever.
Yes, he might have been grateful, but I can tell you when I viewed that, he was never intimidated. His
right.
intensity was just as great as Arnold's or anybody else who was training there, or even better. And
yeah.
I can tell you that was with the cameras or without the cameras on him.
Yeah.
He was always a gentleman, outside of training and inside of training, he was really an animal. He really trained hard. He never held back. His intensity was great. He realized that during a set of an exercise, every rep was a warm-up for the hard ones at the end, and he never backed out of those last repetitions.
Yeah. Now, did you go to the Mr. Olympia the first time it was in Columbus in 1976?
I was in Columbus in 1976. As a matter of fact, I covered the contest for Ironman.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And it was the first time I saw Corny pose. And the only time that Corny was outdone was by himself the following year. But I did, I did make a note, and I did put it in print in 1976. And I would stand by it this day that a video should have been made of his posing routine that should have been kept for posterity, that every future pro or amateur could look at that video and understand the best way or the most exciting, dynamic way to show off your physique. And I'll tell you another thing about it. I'll tell you another thing about Ed Corny. He never had to hold his hand up to his ear to encourage the audience to applaud for him when he was posing.
No, never.
Never.
That horrendous practice was not around back then.
You know, I will reflect to you, John, that the two greatest ovations I ever heard for a physique competitor were in 1965 at the Brooklyn Academy of Music for Larry Scott.
Right.
And in 1977 for Ed Corny in Columbus, Ohio. And John Balick said to me, and I think he was spot on when he said, there was 2,200 people watching Scott in 65, and there was 3,500 watching Corny in 77.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, great. So, you know, he got the greatest ovation I ever heard
in
a bodybuilding contest.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was there too in 77. And now 77, if we can reflect upon that for a second, that was a pretty amazing year for bodybuilding, because that was the year that Pumping Iron came out, which was released in January. And maybe people don't remember this at the time, but it was kind of a smaller movie, more of a kind of an art house movie that was only released in certain theaters around the United States. It wasn't a big release. It wasn't like The Avengers or Black Panther or anything like that. So not many people really saw it, but I think all those of us in the bodybuilding community saw it. And so later that year, on October 1st, that was when the Mr. Olympia was held in Columbus, Ohio. And Franco was the winner the year before, but he had injured his leg in that World's Strongest Man contest. So Franco wasn't coming back. So the contest was really up for grabs. And Frank Zane had taken second to Franco the year before, so he was one of the favorites. But I think everybody was looking at Robbie Robinson as the guy who was going to win. And, of course, Lou Ferrigno was also supposed to go in it. And then Lou dropped out because he got the Hulk role. But when Ed Corny came out, number one, he was in great shape, probably the best shape he'd been in definitely since 1975, because I think in 76 he was a little bit off. So he came out in 77. But because, and this is my opinion, I think because that movie Pumping Iron came out that year, and Ed was featured extensively in the movie as Arnold's training partner, and then they also focused on his posing at the prejudging of the 1975 Mr. Olympia, and that's when Arnold's in the audience with Danny Padilla and Robbie, and he goes, "Wow, that's what I call posing."
I think you mean 1976 on that. When Arnold was in the audience, 75 was in Pretoria, but 76 was in Columbus. So Arnold happened to be sitting right behind me, and did turn around to Christine Zane and tell her, I believe that was the year, that how good Frank looked in 76. But Arnold did say that year also that Corny, this is the best posing routine he'd ever seen.
Oh, and really? He said that in 76. Okay. Yeah, I was talking about the scene in Pumping Iron where he said that, you know, to Robbie and Danny.
Well, he said it more than once, but I will say something else. I'll add on to what you're saying. It was that 76 and 77 were important years because Arnold retired in 75.
Right.
That means, but for the first time in a while, the Mr. Olympia contest was really up for grabs.
Right.
And it was the best time in bodybuilding, I'd say, the late 70s, because you really went to the contest really not knowing who was going to win. It was always my opinion from 1977 on, at least, even maybe 76, but 77 on, that it was going to be Robbie Robinson, because early in the year, you had to see Robbie Robinson just to see how tremendous a physique that man was. A front double bicep, in my opinion, that has never been repeated. But getting back to Corny, it was interesting that you say that Corny's popularity grew so explosively from the movie, but exactly the opposite happened for a great physique of Ken Waller, who, because of the movie and through no fault of his own, became the villain because of the whole Mike Katz stage stage episode, which really was, you know, part of, you know, just the drama of the movie. But Waller was also, even though in tremendous shape in the early 70s, looking really good in the mid 70s, but yet he couldn't overcome the role that he had in that movie, which I think was a disservice to a great physique.
Oh yeah, yeah, very, very unfortunate.
As good as Ed Corny was in 76, the first time I saw him, 77 was the greatest posing routine that, in my opinion, ever occurred at any level, professional and amateur. I think Chris Dickerson learned an awful lot from watching Ed Corny pose, because Dickerson's posing in the very early 80s was very similar to Corny's, but it did not quite match, you know, the extreme brilliance of what Corny was able to do that night.
Yeah. Now, Roger, you and I have both seen tons of bodybuilding contests, both amateur and professional. And it was really magical what happened that night, because it's kind of, you know, posing is kind of a unique thing, because it's something that's done silently, right? It's done silently on the stage. The guy is not talking. He's just performing. So it's a connection between the bodybuilder and the audience. And for some reason, whatever happened that night, it was just so magical, because Corny caught that audience's imagination or whatever, and the place just went insane. It went nuts. And of course it was because of his incredible posing, and he was in great shape. But how often have we ever seen anything like that happen? And I've tried to describe, you know, what it was like, because I was there and I was a novice. I was only 14 years old, and it was one of the first contests I ever saw. But it was just an amazing experience being there and watching Corny do this incredible posing, and the connection he had with the audience. And the reaction he had, it was like, I think there was 3 standing ovations that day, right?
Well, I'll tell you one thing to add on to what you're saying. The best physique that night, in my opinion, was Frank Zane, and he deserved to win the Mr. Olympia. But
right.
Ed Corny nearly stole that Olympia. And if he had been declared the winner after that posing routine, I don't think you would have seen any of the rioting that took place in 1980 or 81. And second of all, that what I don't think people realize, that Corny gave the greatest posing performance of his career at 44 years old.
Yeah.
It's not like this was a young guy coming up who startled the world. This
right.
This guy was older than any other competitor in the contest that night.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's something that's sort of forgotten about. And I remember in Pump Again, they mentioned that he was in his 40s. But yeah, Ed was born in 1933, so he got into bodybuilding kind of late, and he really was at his peak when he was in his mid-40s. That's just amazing.
Yeah, and the fact that he took, you know, I think third that night or whatever he did.
Yeah, third. Mm-hmm.
To Zane and to Robbie, a tremendous credit to him. And I think realistically it was a high point of his career.
Yeah.
And the best, you know, his best placing, even though he had won the universe earlier in the IFB Mr. America, I think that third place Olympian 77 was the culmination of Ed Corny's great career.
Yeah.
And it's just very sad that, you know, that he got ill and that he succumbed to this aneurysm on January 1st. He's really a great of the game. And I think what I read recently is that Arnold has suggested at the next Olympia that there would be a best poser or best in and have the posing award, the Ed Corny.
Yeah, he did. Award. I read that too. That's awesome.
Yeah, that is a tremendous and well-deserved honor.
Yeah, yeah. So at least the younger people can always remember his name, you know, even if they haven't had a chance to see him or they don't know who he is.
Yeah, I would advise bodybuilders, whether amateur or professional, who really don't have any idea what posing should be these days, to find a video of what that man did in 77 and emulate it as best as they can, which will probably, you know, not be anywhere near what this guy did. Because if you remember his posing, he was almost looked like he was on a revolving pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
He could make a complete 360 turn. But there was no revolving pedestal. It was him being able to move his feet and his body around in harmony to show his, you know, front, side, and back. And, oh, my God, you couldn't believe what you're seeing. And then people would stand up and cheer for him. And it was, and then flash bulbs would go off. And it was the whole nine yards. I mean, it was really quintessential showmanship in those golden days.
Yeah. And one thing I read an article by Ed, and one thing he said, and this is true, is that when he posed, even though he posed very smoothly and you know, with great transitions, it was almost a masculine way he did it. You know, it was very powerful. It wasn't, I guess, in the book Pumping Iron, they compare Frank Zane's posing to Ed Corney's posing, and they make a mention of how Ed Corney does it the best. Because Frank did it, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with the way Frank did it, but it was more balletic, you know, where Corney did it in a way where the transitions were very powerful and very masculine, and it was just an amazing thing to see.
Really, you really couldn't compare Corney's posing to anybody else's. Arnold was very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Arnold's posing was tremendously improved from 1970 to 1975. And I think one of the reasons it was so improved is he was so confident in the way he looked, and just the way, you know, Arnold was, you know, supreme confidence in everything he did, and it just reflected in his posing. Zane was just a different type of poser. But I'll tell you a quick anecdote that I think you'll find interesting. In early 1976, in the winter, the Whitney Museum in New York, which is, you know, a famous art museum, held a what they call bodybuilding as art evening for bodybuilders. And John Balick and I, John, who used to live in Philadelphia, traveled up there and met up with Arnold and Frank Zane and Ed Corney. And Arnold had just retired. But of the three bodybuilders, the only one who was in shape that February evening in 1976 was Ed Corney. And he stole the show at the Whitney. And the funny thing was that Zane was up there, and Zane looked to me to be about 20 pounds lighter than I had seen him before, and way, way softer. And I said to John Balick, I said, there's no way that Frank Zane is going to enter the Olympian 76. I think he must be retiring. Well, not only did he not retire, he looked absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
1976, had almost won the Olympia. Franco.
Right.
And was very disappointed what he did. And then I said to myself, you know what? I understand nothing about contest prep. And I definitely understand why Zane is called the chemist, because whatever he did between February and September of 76 was extraordinary. But the point being that Corney was in shape then, and quite frankly, I never really saw Corney out of shape, realizing that he was 44 in 1977. So, you know, subsequently his decline over the years as far as placings can be understood. And then, of course, in the 90s, he came back and entered, you know, the Masters post-60 Olympia, and I think he won several times.
Yeah.
So he could always be counted on to be in shape, that's for sure.
Now let's talk about 78. I mean, you were at that show also, and I was as well. And I remember Ed, after taking third, I thought he would be one of the favorites. And unfortunately, I think he placed only seventh. But I was really impressed with the way he looked in 78. I thought physically he was even in better shape. He looked thicker to me and more cut. And he did a really unique posing routine, and I got to give him credit for this, you know, because he was trying to do something that no one else had done. And you could see he was really, you know, pushing the boundaries of just expanding his art of posing. And that's where he did the thing where he had one arm up over his head straight, and the other arm was straight out in front of him, and then he turned in a circle like a clock on stage. You remember that?
Yeah, I thought that he had done that in 77, as I alluded to, but I think that you're probably right. And as a matter of fact, though my memory is a little bit faded, he did come to me after that contest and ask about his placing. And you know, it's so totally subjective, but I thought he was a bit heavy. And, you know, I told him so, and he did say, you know what, I was sharper the past year, and I don't feel that I could compete being sharper against these guys when the sport seems to be getting heavier.
And oh, wow.
But, you know, he was sincere. But I said to him, if I was you, I would be the best that I can be and ignore the surroundings.
Yeah.
And I would have given him the same advice today. I mean, even back in the 70s, as you know, I mean, when you had such different types of physiques, you know, you had that Richard Baldwin type of really lean, muscular, great physique. Mm-hmm. And then you had the really big guys who outweighed Baldwin by 20, 30 pounds.
Yeah.
You had a completely different type of physique. But you couldn't change to redefine yourself and to remake yourself. By that time, I don't think it could be done. And Boyer Coe, I think, pointed that out. He said, I am what I am.
Mm-hmm.
The audience expects me to be better every single year. Is that really realistic?
Mm-hmm.
So I gave the advice according to my sincere advice as a judge. And he took it, and I think he went, you know, he agreed with it. But he certainly didn't argue with me or become defensive. And
yeah.
I could very easily have said to him, you're better, bigger. You got to be bigger. The sport's getting bigger. The guys are getting bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Do whatever they can to get bigger. But I didn't. You know, I had to be myself, too. And I told him, be yourself. And whether those words stuck or not, I don't know. But he certainly wasn't down in 78. His body weight was up. And he was right there. He played seventh. But you remember, you know, that competition that year, 77 and 79, you could have placed third to seventh and with a point or so difference. I mean, he beat Boyer Coe in 77 by 1 point, and
yeah.
Boyer Coe was in an amazing shape.
Yeah.
So, so it's subjective, and they use the point system, and it was, you know, they were all neck and neck. From one to seven, you never knew, each year, you know, where the placings would be, which I think made the sport so great during that time.
Yeah, that's great that he came back to you and talked to you, but he wasn't mad at all. I mean, I could tell you,
he was the exception to the rule, I could tell you that.
Yeah, right.
Only one person can win. You know,
it was
an honor to be being a judge all those years. But it, you know, you're dealing with sensitive men who, who train hard all year, some of them, for one contest, and then they have people who support them, who acknowledge them all year. Oh, you can't be beaten.
Yeah,
you can't be beaten. And all of a sudden they're beaten, and then all of a sudden the judges are no good.
Yeah,
but you tried the best you can, and you really try to be efficient. You try to be non-biased, and when you think that you can be as objective as possible, then you take your seat at the judges' table. I recused myself in 1980, and I was a head judge of 81, but I was a non-voting judge. But in 1980, I trained Mike Mentzer the months before the Olympia. I couldn't very, even though I was a head judge of the IFBB, I couldn't very well judge that contest, could I?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It wouldn't have been fair. But if I had, you know, the history of bodybuilding might have been different.
Yeah, right.
Who knows? The same about 81. So I was.
Yeah, well, I could see Ed being a little upset because he did go down from third to seventh. And I think Danny Padilla was sixth, and Cal Scalak was fifth, and Boyer was fourth. Roy Callender was third. Robbie was second again. And then Frank Zane won his second title. So, but I was impressed with the performance. And that posing routine really sticks in my mind. Of course, 77 was the historic one. But I also thought it was pretty cool what he did in 78. It seemed like he was trying to try something different. He was trying to, just expand on what he could do.
I totally agree, but I will say to you that although the placings are so important, I think the ovation he got in 78 was enough for him.
Mm-hmm.
Again, he got the loudest ovation of the night again.
Yeah.
And he plays seventh. And so I think when he approached me afterwards, he wasn't really as despondent as I would say Robbie Robinson was, or certainly Cal Scalic, who impersonated Jesus that night.
Right, and crucified, right. And one thing I want to also mention about Ed is it had to be a great honor for him or a great compliment to him that George Butler and Charles Gaines used his picture on the book of Pumping Iron when he won the 1972 Mr. Universe. They didn't use Arnold, who was, you know, probably the centerpiece of the book, but they did use the picture of Ed Corney, and I thought that was always a great thing because they said that picture encapsulated the joy of bodybuilding, you know, the victory, and Ed really captured it in that photo.
Yeah, I agree with you, although they could have chosen one of 100 pictures, maybe 1,000 pictures to be a cover of that. So I'm sure, hey, you know, he's going to be remembered for the people who were never close enough to bodybuilding to attend contests.
Right.
That's how he's going to be remembered. And of course, during the movie when he was doing those, you know, intense squats. The cover of the book, I mean, you know, they can never take that away from him.
I know.
That was great. And I think really well deserved. And I agree with you. He, with a smile on his face, he did encapsulate the joy of Pumping Iron, I would say.
Yeah. And then when the movie came out a couple of years later, there were a lot of posters for the movie was using the cover of the book as a poster of the movie. So he was also, I think that poster went around. I know I've seen some gyms where they have that poster hanging in there.
I was fortunate enough to be at the premiere of Pumping Iron in New York City.
Wow.
And remember that when we were there, you know, it was great because there's a tremendous amount of bodybuilders there. And believe it or not, most of us came there in tuxedos.
Yeah.
You know, you wanted to feel like you were an important part of that sport's history and that bodybuilding was much more than the stereotype of the guy with nothing above his forehead, with these big muscles and the small head, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And that was kind of close to the epitome that night at that premiere of Pumping Iron with Butler and Gaines. It was unforgettable.
Yeah. Yeah, what a great achievement that was, you know, sort of getting off subject a minute, but the book Pumping Iron and also the movie Pumping Iron, I mean, that really did make the sport more popular, but it was just so well done. I just got a chance to read that book again this week after Ed passed away, and I was reading the sections about him and Mike Katz when they traveled to Baghdad for that 1972 Mr. Universe. But, man, it was so well written. Being a writer myself, I really admired Charles Gaines' writing in that book, and then, of course, George Butler's photos. And they just came together and they created this great, great book that I think will stand the test of time. And it really helped bring a lot of dignity and respect to bodybuilding. And I kind of look at that book as I wish that's the way the sport, that's the ideal of the sport. You know, that's how it could be. That's the ideal of what bodybuilding could be.
For the umpteenth time, I'm going to agree exactly for what you're saying. But I think that horse has left the barn, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. But it's nice to look back at that.
I don't know if we'll ever get back to what we saw. We're just fortunate enough to be there.
Yeah.
And because you do these podcasts, at least it takes people back to a time where common sense in bodybuilding was almost common.
Well, that's why I do them, because I like talking about those days because it was so special to me and to a lot of other people.
I agree.
When Ed continued to compete, he did the Olympia in 79. He was in there in 1980 and 81 when Arnold and Franco won. And you could tell he really loved the sport because he kept doing it even as he got older. I remember he did a great routine in 83 when it was in Munich, Germany, when Stumir won. And, of course, he was past his peak then, but he was still in great shape. And I don't know how old he would have been, 83. I'm sure in his 50s, but he was still in amazing shape. And we don't think about bodybuilders being old back then, but he was much older than almost everybody except probably Albert Beckles. And he was just in great shape, and he was just doing it for the love of the sport. And his posing routine that night in Munich was really great. I think he posed, that's when he posed in My Way, wasn't it, with Frank Sinatra?
You know, 1980, I retired in 1982.
Okay.
When my wife came back from Israel, my soon-to-be wife came back from Israel, and I wrote a letter to Ben Weider to retire from judging, but so I missed 83.
Okay.
But from what I heard, it's Amir deserved to win that. If I have one major regret in my decisions over the years, he deserved to win in 82, I think, also, which he placed fourth. But
yeah.
Besides the point, Courtney was, to his credit, kept on competing, and he did it for the love of the sport. He mm-hmm. wasn't competitive anymore, but he stayed sharp. And I think that it did well for him because he continued to stay in shape into the 60s. And again, when they had the short-lived Masters over 60, he won. So
yeah, mm-hmm.
more power to him, you know.
Yeah, he just seemed like a guy who – he really loved bodybuilding, and he really understood, you know, he really had a love for the training of the sport, and he just did it for himself, you know. And he just did it because he really had a passion for it, and then he would just use the competitions as an extension of that. But it wasn't like he had a win. I think he just did it because he really loved it.
Yeah, but it also showed that I think most of the year he was able to stay in shape. He never seemed to be the type of guy who really got out of shape during the off season, ate too much, and had to train back into being in shape. He was only a few pounds over contest prep most of the year, if I remember correctly. So he always knew how to stay lean and stay sharp, and it always made it so he could extend his career. I think that was smart thinking.
And then Ed was always a staple at the Arnold Classic. I don't know about the Olympia, but the Arnold Classic, I remember always seeing him there every year. You know, over the last 10 years, he was always, I think, at the Europa booth, and he was there with his big training partner, a guy who was, I don't know what the guy's name is, but he was a big Samoan-like guy. And Ed was always there signing pictures and was very, very attentive and very nice to everybody who came up to him. And I remember he really loved the ladies. I remember one year I brought my girlfriend at the time up there, and he was like, he spent more time looking at her and talking to her. You know, he was almost like he was trying to take her away from me, you know, than he was talking to me. So I heard stories about him doing that with the other women too. He really loved the ladies, so he always gave them a lot of attention. But he was always a great guy, you know.
He must have been a major inspiration to you because every year you managed to try to emulate him in a way to peak one time a year and to see what kind of shape you can get in as the years progress.
Yeah,
and the pictures that you put out there, you managed to do that quite well.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think it's good to, if you're a bodybuilder, to, you know, sort of stay in touch with the sport in a way, you know, and just try to peak every year and never lose sight of that. And like you said, Ed was like that too, because he was always in good shape, and he never had to go far to get ready for a contest.
That seemed to be the way he was. That's the way I saw it anyway. Every time I saw it, he was never far out from being in shape.
Yeah. Well, he must have meant a lot to a lot of the people in the bodybuilding world, Roger, because this week when he passed away on Facebook, there were just so many people who really spent the time to write something about him and to say, you know, it's so sad that we lost this guy. And even though he was now 85 and, you know, he was in his peak, you know, in the 1970s, that's a long way away. So he was obviously someone who was still well remembered. And that made me feel good to see that so many people in bodybuilding. Well, I know Lee Haney put something up, and Rachel McLish put something up, and I think Tom Platz put something up. I guess Tom and his wife were very close to him. So it was just great to see all these former champions say something about Ed Courtney. That just showed you what an impact he had on the sport and that hopefully he will not be forgotten.
I agree, and it also shows the camaraderie that there mm-hmm. was during this so-called golden age. And of course, it was also the infancy of the women's bodybuilding movement. So I wasn't surprised when Rachel McLish finally remembered him, or Tanya Knight, or Mary Jarumbo, or any mm-hmm. of those early great female bodybuilders who remember their time in the sport. And their recollections are pretty much spot on with ours. You know, it was a great time. And he was a central figure through the whole thing.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, he really led the way with the posing, and that was just such a special impact he made on the sport. And I think it's great that Arnold's going to do this at the Arnold Classic now, because, like I said, at least his name will always be alive, and we won't forget about him. And, you know, it's not like he died a young man. He lived a full life. He died, you know, at 85 years old. Of course, we all want to live forever, but, you know, he lived a full life, and it just we don't want to see a guy like that go, because he was such a great guy, and he's still full of life. When I saw him at the Arnold Classic every year, he was always, even though he was getting older, he just had that sparkle in his eye. He was so full of life. So, but he will always be remembered, definitely by me and those of us who love the sport, because he did have such a special impact, not only with his physique, but with the posing and just his attitude and the way he presented himself.
Yeah, I would say on reflection, we can say definitively that he was always ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
He was always trying something new, to improve on what he was and what he could be. So it's with total respect that I have this conversation with you in remembering him. Just a great champion at a great time, a great personality, and a guy who I would say without reservations realized his full physical potential.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we'll always remember him, and it's sad to see our heroes dying from the golden age, but it's going to happen to every one of us. So at least he'll always be remembered, and, you know, I hope we're able to shed some light on how great he was on the show with this interview to those of the people out there, the listeners out there who weren't around to see him, you know, at his peak.
Well, I'm happy to be with you today, and I'm glad that we did this, and I think we made our points very well, and I think people respect the sincerity that we showed to a great man, a great champion.
Right, absolutely. All right, Roger, well, thanks again for joining us on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I hope to have you on again soon in the near future, because it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and you were around for so many great moments of the sport. And again, Happy New Year to you and your family, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon, Roger.
Yes, my respect to you always. Take care.
All right. Man. Thanks, Roger. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. So thank you for listening to this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank Mike Kast, and I also want to thank Roger Schwabs for taking the time to join us to offer their thoughts about Ed Corney. Now, before we leave, I do want to read to you guys an article from the December 1976 issue of Muscle Builder and Power magazine. And of course, this was the precursor to Muscle and Fitness magazine, but this was the magazine that Joe Weider had in the 1970s. And there is an article in there about Ed Corney, and I actually have this magazine in my collection. So I wanted to bring it out, and I actually got a chance to read it this week. And I was really, really moved and impressed by Ed Corney's thoughts and insights into being a bodybuilder. So I'm basically going to read this article to you guys. I hope it's not too long, and I hope you get a chance to enjoy it. But I thought it was really a great article to share, and I wanted to share it with you. And I had a chance, as I said, I had this magazine in my possession, so I thought it was great to share it with you so you can get a sense of who Ed Corney was as a bodybuilder. So as I mentioned, this was in the December issue of 1976 in Muscle Builder magazine, so it came out in 1976. This was a year after Ed took second place in the Mr. Olympia contest in the under 200-pound class to Franco, and that was filmed for the movie Pumping Iron, and he was also the training partner of Arnold for that movie and for that contest. So in this article, Ed talks about his experience of training with Arnold. So the article starts off where Ed says, "I had to make up my mind. Was I going to compete in the Mr. Olympia or what? 1975 was already half gone. It was the first time that a major world contest would be held according to weight classes, two of them, divided at the 200-pound mark. I knew for sure who I would have to face in the under 200. One was Franco, the other was Frank Zane, three-time Mr. Universe winner, who fell 1 point short of victory over Franco the year before in New York in 1974. The target was November in South Africa. For days I contemplated the idea. I couldn't think of anything else. Where would I train? How would I train? What kind of restrictions would I put against myself? I'm the co-owner of a nightclub, Fonzie's, in San Francisco, and it takes up a lot of my time. George Butler of Pumping Iron had called me and asked me if I would come down to Los Angeles to work in this picture. I live in San Francisco. Armed with twin purposes, I told my partners at the club that I was leaving to train for the Mr. Olympia and that I would be gone for 3 months. I told my fiance I was leaving and that I would be gone for 3 months. It was the only way I felt I could get into professional shape. I remember calling Arnold in Santa Monica and asking him if I could come down there and train with him. He had just finished making a movie from the book Stay Hungry, and he was down to 210 pounds body weight. Lean, but not out of shape, he said. Arnold said over the phone he knew that if he wanted to get back to 235 in perfect shape, he would have to do a lot of training, a lot of good eating, be in the right atmosphere and the right frame of mind. He said ever since he had returned, it was July, he had been fooling around training with different guys in search of a suitable training partner, which he had always felt to be a most important part of his training. In the process, he said he had asked himself which of the guys was the most hungry. Kent Keene wasn't hungry. Danny Gable was only half hungry. Ken Waller liked to fool around too much. No one else at the time seemed geared for the effort that he contemplated. He, too, wanted to train for the Mr. Olympia. He wanted to win it for the sixth time. When I told him how I felt about wanting to win Mr. Olympia, I guess I must have sounded very convincing because Arnold said, yes, he'd be glad to start training with me. I told him I wanted to beat everybody, and that's all he needed to hear. He tells me now that I sounded just as hungry as he was. We had trained together for a short period in Germany a few years previously, so he was aware of my nature and my capability. It was summer, and the first day I stepped out on Venice Beach, I heard someone say, he's fat. I weighed 187. I was fat. If you want to be the best, you train with the best. Our training sessions were unbelievable. Arnold went up in body weight. I went down. In that way, we are opposites. In another way, we are similar. Our arms are our strong points. We have the kind of bodies that can do any pose. He's the big version. I'm the small one. We worked out twice a day using the Weider double split system, 6 days a week. We squatted until we fell on the floor. We used every training trick in our books. In the meantime, we were filming Pumping Iron. After the first few weeks, we decided that I should move into his house with him so we could eat together, get our schedules together, and fine focus our efforts on the big goal. Arnold enjoyed it immensely. We went to the beach together, to parties, to the gym. It was a joy. It had a lot of meaning. I wish all of life was like that. Arnold couldn't believe the way I was changing from day to day. Abdominals, intercostals. I got up to 2,500 sit-ups, twists and crunches every day. I got into the gym in the morning an hour before him so I could work on my abdominals. He was doing 500 reps himself every day. We dieted. No cookies, no cakes. We both loved that stuff. Arnold was so strict, he went down in body weight, finally competing at 225 instead of the expected 235. The 2 months that we trained together both put us in the best shape of our lives. Arnold's description of my appearance at the South Africa Mr. Universe show stands on a pedestal in my mind like the ultimate trophy. We looked up at you there and we couldn't believe our eyes. It was a beautiful finished piece of art. 10 of us bodybuilders from all over the world were sitting there in the first row watching your posing during the prejudging. You went through your routine without a mistake for 3 minutes like a flowing Michelangelo statue. No one could find a word of criticism, a rare condition for such a sophisticated lot. We were enchanted. I felt like I had a hand in it. I was emotionally involved. Call me Dr. Frankenstein or something. You had defined a part of bodybuilding up there that none of us were able to do. Arnold said that, and I'll always thrill at the thought of his words. I feel terribly lucky. Of course, he had his other favorite there, Franco. He had always been involved in Franco's efforts in the same emotional way. Now he saw the both of us, Franco and I, competing together for the lightweight bodybuilding prize, and that fascinated him. Mix that in with his emotional involvement for both of us, and you get the drama and intrigue Arnold loves. I was born in Honolulu, Hawaii in 1933. That makes me 43, in my prime for bodybuilding, I think. I had the advantage of growing up in paradise, but following a 4-year stint in the Coast Guard, I settled in mainland America in the city of Fremont, California. I was 26. I was impressed by the currently famous muscle men at that time, fellows like Jack Dellinger and Alan Steven. But though it started me working out, I had no desire to become a competitive bodybuilder. I trained for 10 years, entirely unheard of at 36. At that time, there happened to be a Mr. Fremont contest coming up. I decided why not give it a try, so I applied the pressure for a few months. I won the contest and also most muscular, and right then something took hold of me. I got fascinated with the concept of contest dieting, the intensity, the dieting, the posing on stage. And I couldn't believe all the attention I got just for developing myself better than anybody else. Then came Mr. Heart of California, Mr. Central California, Mr. Northern California, and all these regional titles. I kept winning them all the way to Mr. West Coast. I love the satisfaction of development, the individual effort. It's hard to explain to anyone the effort that goes into it. I weighed about 140 pounds at 5'6", and the more I trained, the more muscle I got. In 1957, when I started, I could merely gape at fellows like Bruce Randall, Reg Park, and Steve Reeves, the big ones. Reeves became my idol. 10 years later, competing then, I saw a completely new group, Scott, Draper, Oliva, and Sipes. I first met Arnold at a Fresno, California contest I was in. I thought he was fat, and he thought I was fat, but we were both hopeful. We met again at the 1971 Mr. California contest, which I won. I had changed. Arnold, who had never missed watching a contest, mentioned that I had risen above mediocrity and was becoming a great bodybuilder, and ever curious as to why, asked me how come. I said that the steady competition had paid off, and I always tried to learn something from each contest and from each workout. In 1971, I won my height class in the IFBB Mr. America in a great contest that featured the likes of such super animals as Ken Waller and Boyer Coe. I did take best poser, however. I had won Mr. Western America just prior to that. I had switched from the AAU to the IFBB after calculating a fix in my course and the traverse through this game. Arnold helped me decide. He clearly stated the advantages of going IFBB as I became more prominent in bodybuilding. I listened to him. In such matters, Arnold doesn't react emotionally. He sees advantage in anything that helps promote bodybuilding. He stated the facts, the good and the bad points of both organizations, and so I went IFBB, which is my affiliation to this day. That year, 1971, I also won Mr. USA. Franco won Mr. World, and that same night. Bodybuilding had reached another milestone that night. Both Franco and I won the overall titles, although we were in the short classes. It proved that a good small man can beat a good big man. We had set a precedent that proved everyone has an equal opportunity in bodybuilding competition. I had to beat Harold Poole, who won the Mr. USA, in the tall class. I could hardly believe what I had done. It still blows my mind every time I think of it. From that victory, I went to Germany, and with Arnold, we both trained and prepared for the Mr. Universe and the Mr. Olympia to be held in Paris. I got to know him well during that period, and our intense desire for our respective goals gave us a rapport that exists to this day. We are fine friends. I am a borderline case at my height, so I was able to compete in the medium class. I came in third. Still, it was a momentous year for me. I had come from small regional victories to place high in world competition. The medium class has always been the toughest, and to make it worse, I had to face the likes of Albert Beckles in Paris. I had a good feeling, even in defeat that year. I experienced a kind of enlightenment, a voice from the mountain that told me I was destined for big things. I knew that I would one day be Mr. Universe. I think all the champs experience this feeling at a specific point in their careers, a revelation that borders on divine, that tells them they will be king. I returned to my training with greater dedication. I issued any layoff and remained on the strictest diet the entire subsequent year. I turned it into a prolonged period of countdown training. I wanted immortality. What stronger desire? Arnold also has thoughts about that brief key period in a bodybuilder's life. Every great success is marked by a year of consummate effort involving absolute adherence to diet and 2 or 3 hours of daily training. Like he says, it only happens once in a lifetime. In truth, it's like that. Any great bodybuilder who sums up his career always finds an increment of possibly a year where his total effort turned the tide of his life. It never happens twice. The vision began to materialize in 1972 with my overall victory in the Mr. America contest. I tore down the fences between classes. Again, I proved the superiority of the small man. Then came Baghdad Mr. Universe contest, 1972, an Olympic year in which the Arab state was a no-show at the games. Their war year, bodybuilding brushed aside international ill will and confirmed the friendship of nations in athletics. Mike Katz and I were the only reps from America. Waller got injured doing 1,000-pound leg presses. I had been sizing up Mike long before the contest, and inside me, I felt I had the edge in symmetry and shape. Mike is big and terrific, but I knew I was ordained to win. In Baghdad, sharing a room, training together, and waiting for the contest, we understood our situation. We already knew. He would win the tall class, and I would win the short class. Fate alone would decide the overall winner. I knew I was going to win. Mike knew he was going to win. I won. I was Mr. Universe overall for 1972. This is the one thing about bodybuilding. It draws you together. You share something that nobody else has. You can understand a guy losing. You can understand him winning. In truth, you need him. He is vital to your efforts. Your regard for him is as great as your own ego. Arnold told me when he won his first Mr. Universe, his lament was, "My God, I've won. What else is there? Where do I go from here?" Here I was now, Mr. Universe. I had reached the top. I had proved that perfection can win over size. I had wiped out all the big guys. Still, I asked, had I really reached the top? Then and there, I made a quick mental adjustment, and I told myself this wasn't the top. I still wanted to compete some more. I continued as an amateur, and in the following 2 years, I won my height class in the Mr. World and Mr. International. But somehow, the victories weren't as sweet. They were lesser titles than the Mr. Universe. Also, I was in lesser condition. Arnold noticed it both times. He told me so when we were working on the movie together in Alabama. They were important titles, but they didn't spark me to train as I did for the Baghdad contest. Then we got to talking about the possibility of entering the Mr. Olympia, the ultimate professional contest. Arnold thought I could handle it. George Butler and Charles Gaines urged me to try, although I was only in halfway shape while working on their movie. With thoughts of the big international meet in South Africa going around in my mind, I headed home to San Francisco. It was the summer in Santa Monica. Arnold had invited me to train with them. The Mr. Olympia contest would be held in November. That's when somebody called me fat. The competition of Franco has always been a thorn in my side. We happened to exist at the same moment in time. Regulations put us in the same class. We are the same size. We seek the same prize. We are friends, yet we both draw individual circles around our desired domain. They overlap, and we know it will lead to dispute. When I used to see Franco or Zane come into the gym, Zane, too, was a thorn in my other side. While Arnold and I were hard at it, I would say to myself, those rat finks, I got to get them by the neck. And the only way to do it was to train hard. I could feel the energy flowing back and forth between me and Arnold. We never uttered a word of complaint. Named the exercise, and we did it with everything we had. My energy was snowballing, and I kept thinking, more, more. I was hungry. Arnold saw part of the best features of my close competitors in me, Franco's Herculean muscle and Zane's flowing proportion. He couldn't have been more fascinated by the possibilities in the upcoming fight. That I should possess each of their top qualities intrigued him. He restrained the gleeful belief that I had them both by the nuts. In Pretoria, South Africa, on the 8th of November, 1975, we fought it out. Arnold said it was immediately clear that when we all lined up, the ones under 200, me, Franco, Beckles, Zane, Bill Grant, and Deanna, and gave the double bicep shot, the contest was reduced to Franco and me. The judges immediately sent the others back and asked me and Franco to pose together. It's a scary feeling standing there next to your mortal enemy, waiting for the first pose to be called. It's you and Franco now, nobody else. You've done your homework, and you wonder if it's been enough. It's never enough. Then you hear the voice of the inquisitor. Front double biceps, please. He often softened the demand for blood with politeness. You hit it. Give it everything you've got. Hope you peak up. Hope the separation shows. Hope everything's perfect, better than Franco's. Side chest pose. You think of all those bench presses and flies and dips and hope the striations stand out and the rib cage is up. Then more changes. You do your thing, pose after pose. You are after your competitor, but you are also after the judges. Can you convey it to the judges? According to the score sheet, I beat Franco on the individual posing, but in the next phase, posing alongside him, I lost. The total scores favored Franco by a few points, close considering the 200-pound limit. Yes, I lost to Franco, but I don't consider the contest a loss. If Franco got me on muscle mass, especially the back, I got him on the posing. There was a fast exchange of qualities. I've always taken posing from a spectator's point of view, someone who's never seen a bodybuilder before. There has to be a flowing animal grace. moves must be functional. What's the use of developing your body to a professional degree if you can't display it in a professional manner? Arnold and I even went to a Santa Monica ballet teacher for advice. She readily related ballet to posing. I also like to dance. I think a bodybuilder can be graceful in a very manly way. As a result, I attempted to develop a style of posing that would be pleasing to anyone from any walk of life. Arnold, who always seems to be watching with the third eye and listening with the third ear, says he feels I tend to set a mood for the audience, to arouse something dormant in them that didn't surface until I started moving. I turn them on, he says. Arnold pissed off all the other contenders in the South Africa Olympia by saying the quality of my posing couldn't be matched by all of them put together, and he included himself. Well, I'm truly flattered. It's nice to know, for a change, that I got something the great Arnold wants. Will there be a mad scramble for my words of wisdom? First of all, you can't copy. Each man must create his appeal in his distinctive way. The most important point, I think, is care about your audience. When you have become perfect, for their sake, they can't help but love you. I'm asked if I intend to compete against Franco and beat him in the 1976 Olympia. My answer is unequivocally yes. Arnold this time will be promoting, and I am sorry. I wish I could train together for it again. He's retiring from competition to go on to bigger things, as they say. But not better. Never. Never. That's me on the cover of Pumping Iron. It's a representative picture. It could have been Arnold, Franco, or Zane, or anybody. It's not a formal pose. I have both my arms flung up in an expression of joy. Butler, Gaines, Arnold, all of whom did so much to produce this book, insisted on that picture. I hope it will convey to the public the feeling that I am expressing. It's a joyous, exciting, healthful, magnificent adventure. Rest in peace, Ed Corney. We'll never forget you. All right, guys, thanks for enjoying the Bodybuilding Legends podcast this week, and we will see you next week. Thanks to our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. Have a great week, everybody. Take care.